I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
When I became a mom for the very first time, I thought that it would be hard, but I had absolutely no idea how much economics and finances would affect my life. I had no appreciation for how expensive it was to raise kids. And that is shocking to me because now, especially as a mom with a large family, I think about personal finances and the home economics of raising a family every single day, every hour of every single day. And maybe I should have known better, but I ended up learning it the hard way. When we think about the economy, I think we often think of this big corporate Wall Street thing. And in reality, it is us too. It is especially working families who are spending that money raising the next generation. And yet we live in a country that has not chosen to invest in certainly mothers, working families, and children. When we think about things like the accessibility or inaccessibility of childcare, the unaffordability of childcare, not to mention medical expenses and early childhood education, we are up against a lot economically. And I really appreciate those in our culture who are helping to break down the way that we have traditionally perhaps thought about the economy as this big thing that's out there and reframed it as this more intimate thing that happens in our lives and certainly shapes our day-to-day decisions and stresses and dreams as parents. Hey, Mama, welcome to the Motherly Podcast, where we have honest conversations about modern motherhood. I am Liz Tennedy. I'm a co-founder at Motherly. I'm also a mother of five myself. Today's guest is Abba Badarai, who I used to work with at the Washington Post. We used to sit really close to one another in the newsroom. Abba is an economics reporter for the Washington Post, where, among other topics, she has been covering the economics of childcare. So many of her stories end up on the front page. I am so proud of her. In this conversation, we talk about the current state of the childcare crisis in the United States, as well as how the landscape of working motherhood has really shifted since the pandemic, and what Abba sees as the future of mothers and work. Abba also shares how her background as the daughter of immigrants and her experiences as a working mother, enduring as well through the pandemic, have really helped to shape how she sees and reports on the American economy. Abba Badarai, welcome to the Motherly Podcast.
Thanks so much, Liz. It's great to be here.
So I always want to know what surprised my guest about motherhood. I think it tells us a lot about the journey that you've been on. So what was it, Abba, that you found surprising?
Honestly, the thing that surprised me the most is just how much it's constantly changing. My kids are 5 and 8 now, and my experience of motherhood and parenthood feels so different than it did a few years ago. I thought I was going to be a parent and that was it. But it's so fluid. It's so dynamic. It's constantly changing. Even the basics, like nurturing them or offering stability, like all of those things are changing too all the time. And so it keeps things challenging. I'm constantly learning, but that's also what makes it so exhilarating, I think.
I totally agree. What stage of growth are you going through right now?
a lot of my friends are having babies right now for the first time. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, I remember what that was like, trying to figure out the breast pump and the car seat and like how to attach it to the stroller. It just feels like such a different place from, you know, like I can't even remember being there. But like now I'm at a point where my kids are pretty self-sufficient. Like they can entertain themselves pretty well for 60 to 70% of the time. And so I really enjoy their company more and more. And I feel like a lot of the baby wrangling is over and we're sort of hitting this new stage of having full-fledged kids.
Oh, I love that for you. And I felt that so much too as a new mom again, 11 years into motherhood. I feel like I'm such a different new mom now than the new mom that I was, but I'm happy for you to be in such a good place. So Abba, you and I used to work together at the Washington Post. Full disclosure, Abba and I, at the very beginning of our careers, we were on the same team and we're also friendly. And I feel like I've gotten to see a little bit behind the scenes of your life as both this working mom of two and an economics reporter for the Washington Post. Is this what you saw for yourself growing up? What did little Abba want to be when she grew up?
You know, I always loved writing. I loved talking to people and I absolutely wanted to be a reporter. So yeah, this is as close to my dream job that I think I could have imagined for myself as a kid. And I really feel lucky to be able to do this every day. And I also feel really lucky to be able to bring my own experience as a parent and a working parent into my stories and my understanding of the economy and the workforce and just what it takes for so many people to get to work in the first place. So I feel like all of that just melds very nicely and I feel super privileged to be doing this.
So I am so glad you said that and brought that up because as someone who knows you and gets to see what your day-to-day life is like through the little snippets, also the fact that you are so regularly writing and reporting on economic coverage that is A1, above the fold, shaping national and international conversation about the economy. I notice that you are able in your work and in perhaps the way that economic coverage in general has evolved to be more inclusive of areas of the economy that haven't traditionally been covered, particularly around parenthood and women's issues and women's employment. So can you talk a little bit about that? Is it true that this is a coverage priority of yours? How do you define your perspective that you're bringing to your objective reporting of the news?
Yeah, absolutely. And I started covering the economy in 2022. So post-pandemic, when I think a lot of these shifts had already happened and childcare and work-life balance was already very much at the forefront of how people are thinking about the economy. But I also find that the types of stories that touch on these challenges and these realities are really what resonate with readers as well. And that's what our readers like. They understand it. It really speaks to their experience in a way that I think more rigid by the numbers reporting maybe doesn't. And last year, I remember one of my favorite stories that I did about a year ago, my daughter got sick with RSV, which was going around. Everybody was sick. I got sick with it. And I remember coming back to work and seeing this data point from the Labor Department that showed that a record number of parents had missed work in October because of COVID, RSV, and the flu. And I ended up writing a story about it, which was shared so widely. It was really a surprise to me. But
me too, because we were sick with it as well.
Yeah, exactly. And like all of these parents were missing work and dealing with all of these challenges at even higher rates than at the height of the pandemic. And I feel like that's one of those things nobody was really putting out there, but it really said a lot about the state that everybody was in.
Tell us a little bit about how you and your husband endured the pandemic as working parents, because I think it kind of sets the groundwork for some of the many topics that you cover in your work and that I want to talk to you about today. So what was your setup?
Oh, it was awful. Well, like everybody else, our kids came home in March 2020 and that was it. We had no childcare anymore. We had no help around the house. We had nothing to help guide us through this. And at that time, we thought this was just for a couple of weeks. And I think in hindsight, maybe that was a really good thing. Because if I had known that my kids would be home without any care for a year and a half, I think I would have just lost it right then and there. But we felt like it was a short-term thing. And so we got better at it as we went along, as I'm sure every other family out there did. But my husband and I would sort of trade off shifts depending on who had a call or a Zoom at what time. And then there was just a whole lot of like staying up very late at night to catch up because my kids were like, they were really young. My youngest daughter was 1.5 and she needed a lot of constant care. Yeah, it was a tough time. But I mean, it's amazing because I still kind of have like PTSD from it. And anytime there's a school closure or somebody's sick and I'm like trying to juggle working at home with them, it's like, oh no, can't go into this again. But my daughter, who's 5, really fondly remembers that time. She's like, I wish I was 2 again because I got to stay home with you all the time. And so that's a nice perspective to have on things, that somehow we survived it.
It's so interesting that your daughter remembers those times fondly because of, I'm sure, the time that they both got to spend with you. Life was slower in some ways, although the way you're describing it, I know it was also hectic in other ways. I remember seeing dads bike with their kids midday in our town. There was no car traffic, you know, in the early weeks and months. No one was going anywhere. But it was like haunting and also beautiful that I got to see fathers interacting with their kids in ways that just, I lived in a place where like most men were commuting into Manhattan and that was it. So yeah, it has like the both and side of it, of what we went through, also transforming and creating new opportunities for how we think about work and family.
That's so true. And it's really made a big positive change in gender divisions within my own household. Like, I feel like my husband and I are true partners in a way that we just weren't before the pandemic. He was in an office job where he wouldn't get home until 7:30, 8 a lot of the time. And so it would just be me and the kids for dinner and then just like frantic scramble to get everything in place for the next day. And now he's in a different position. He's working from home. He does almost all of the childcare drop off and pickups. And like, he's with the kids in the afternoon while I finish my work. And so it's just been a completely radical change for the better for our family. And I see it like at school pickup and drop-offs too. It's a lot more dads than we used to see. And I think there's a lot more flexibility out there, which is a great thing.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think one of the things that's really important for us to acknowledge is that we are ourselves generationally and individually and as families living through a time of profound transformation and reimagining. And it's not all linear when it comes to work and family, right? There is an idea for many women, I'll put myself even in this camp, that there's so many possibilities now. If you are the primary caregiver for your children, but you have career ambitions, there's so much more possible today than before the pandemic in terms of what you can do flexibly and remotely. And then on the flip side, there's still a penalty associated with wanting more flexible work, right? Tend to see reduced pay for those kinds of roles, or even just some stigma that is still out there around this. So I guess from someone who talks to everyday employees, business leaders, economic advisors, and experts, what advice might you have for our listeners who, you know, are moms, many working moms, looking to navigate this new terrain of work and imagining what's possible for themselves going into the future?
I think you've hit it right on the head. There is this new flexibility, but there's also sort of this unspoken penalty behind it in a lot of ways. And we're seeing all of this tension bubble up, employees wanting to work more from home, managers wanting them in the office. But I do feel like we're in a place where we can at least have these conversations and people feel a bit more empowered to push back. I think we're also just logistically set up to work from home more. So if you have a sick kid, you don't have to count it as a complete loss of work day. I mean, you can still balance the two when you have to. But it's been really interesting to watch that unfold. And I did a story recently about all of these companies have mandates now. You have to be in the office 3 days a week or 4 days a week, 5 days in some cases. But people are sort of doing that on their own terms. They're maybe going into the office a little bit later after they drop off their kids or go to the gym. They're leaving a little earlier in the afternoon. And I think that's become a lot of people's ways of just sort of saying, okay, I'll be in the office. Like, I'll have this face-to-face interaction that you want from me, but I'm also going to claim my time and do this in a way that prioritizes what I need. And that doesn't mean they're just going home for the day. I mean, they're going home and logging back in a lot of cases. We're still sort of finding this right balance, I think. But remote work in general has been really great for women in particular and getting them back in the workforce. I mean, I think that's one of the main reasons we've seen so many women roar back into the workforce after the pandemic.
Well said. Well, one thing that is critical to both get and keep women who want to work for pay in the workforce is childcare. And in my time as a journalist, the last 15 years, and my time at Motherly, the last 8 years, I've never seen the topic of childcare reach such a crisis point in our popular culture. And thankfully, because of reporters like you and others, it is becoming a centerpiece of public debate and a growing consensus that this lack of affordable childcare has reached a crisis point. But we don't seem to have any solutions yet. So could you update our listeners on the current state of the so-called childcare cliff?
Yeah, the pandemic really brought into focus just how dire our childcare situation was in. And I remember early on, we were all talking about it as this major turning point. Like things were going to have to get better because they just couldn't get worse. And then the government put $24 billion, which is an unprecedented amount, into shoring up childcare, at least short term. But what's amazing to me is how little has actually changed. That money ran out at the end of September, and a lot of states are scrambling again, trying to figure out where to go from here. That money was really crucial in propping up worker salaries, in providing training programs to get new teachers into the classroom because there has been such a shortage of workers. And some of it was also going directly to families to help them afford this exorbitant cost. And now all of that has faded away, and we are at a point where there are already huge parts of the country without enough childcare. More than 1 in 2 Americans live in a childcare desert as it is. And so now with this loss of funding, nearly 70,000 by some estimates, childcare centers close, which means supply is going down. It's going to be that much harder. Prices are going to go up, and we're sort of in an even worse position than we started off in.
So why are we here, right? We're talking about it. It's in the center of the public debate. Why do you think we do not have a federal policy on affordable childcare?
Gosh, there's so many issues knotted up into this, but I think we just haven't valued women's work for a very long time on both sides of the equation in terms of working parents, working mothers needing to get to work, and also in terms of the childcare workers themselves, who are predominantly women, often women of color, who are extremely underpaid and working these very physically intense jobs. And we just, as a society, have not put any value on that. And so we're at this crisis point where there just isn't enough care. Even if you're willing to pay all the money in the world, in some cases, there just are not enough spots available.
So what are some of the more creative solutions, even if they're not politically feasible today, but what are the ones that you think, you know what, that seems like a viable, modern approach to the issue of affordable childcare?
There are a lot of states that are stepping in and trying to look at this from a holistic approach. And I've seen some of them in particular work with home daycare providers, who are a really important piece of the puzzle, especially in low-income areas or rural areas where it just doesn't make sense to have a huge daycare where everybody lives very far apart. But if you have these smaller in-home centers, you're creating jobs for people in the community, and you're also providing childcare. And so I think that's become a really important avenue that some states and cities have focused in on. But politically, on a national level, I mean, we're at a time where it's just so difficult to have any sort of consensus on anything. And I'm working on a story now about how businesses are stepping up in a new way. Obviously, it's in their self-interest, of course, but we're seeing a lot of companies build new on-site childcare centers, not just for executives working in corporate headquarters, but for manufacturing workers in Tennessee, or even teachers. I talked to this one school, this charter school in Wisconsin, where the director said that he kept having all of these teachers leave the workforce for 2 years when they had kids because they couldn't find infant care. They just couldn't find any slots for their kids until they turned 2. And he was constantly losing teachers year after year. And he decided, you know what, we're just going to take this space off the cafeteria, make a little infant center there. And now they have up to 8 kids that they're watching there so their parents can keep working. So we're seeing innovative approaches in a way that we haven't in the past. And I think companies are also realizing that they need to help cover the cost of childcare, which is becoming more and more difficult for families to afford. So we're seeing a lot more in terms of subsidies from companies or other perks in terms of just helping with that burden.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends.
For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to PrettyLitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
How have you, as a family, navigated childcare in a high cost of living area at a place where I'm sure there's wait lists for years? How has it worked out for you?
Well, my kids are both in public school now, in a charter school, which has been great. So yes, hallelujah.
So happy for you. You made it. Woo!
One drop off, one pick up. But I remember like how awful it was both times. We were on all these daycare wait lists. You didn't know until the last minute if something was going to open up. So we ended up interviewing nannies and just didn't know what to do. Didn't know how we were going to come up with this extra $2,000 a month. And then at that time, before the pandemic, we didn't know if we would be stuck at work after 6 p.m. And so then what do you do? And having to create all of these different backup systems upon backup systems to prepare for every scenario. And we're lucky now that we're at a point where the kids go to school, they go to aftercare sometimes, and then it's much easier for them to go home with a friend if they need to than when they were infants. So I feel like we were over the worst, but I remember just what an overwhelming challenge that was and continues to be for a lot of families. And we really see that, of course, in the summer too, because summer camps are an absolute nightmare, but that's another story.
Maybe this is a bit off the beat of exactly what you cover, but one of the difficulties of raising kids in America is the incompatibility of our work schedules and our school schedules, both of which were designed for a time other than this, right? Whether we're talking about an agrarian society and taking time off in the summer, as children do, for the harvest, or manufacturing-based schedules, the idea of the 40-hour work week itself being an anachronism and not compatible with the fact that so many of us wake up and go to sleep to emails, work emails on our cell phones, right? How do you think about the nature of work and time for families, when we look at school schedules, work schedules, and just the way that we actually live? And what does it take, do you think, to more healthily integrate both work life and family life from a time management perspective?
Gosh, it's such a pain point. And I realize I'm speaking from a place of privilege where I can set my own hours for the most part. And I do work regular 8 to 6 or 8 to 5 or whatever the case may be. And that's not the case for a lot of families who work different shifts and different days. And I think we as a society just don't have anything in place to accommodate those types of schedules, which is really awful. And one of the things that kept coming up in these conversations with companies in like manufacturing and retail, education, medicine, where the norm is these overnight shifts or these 12 or 16 hour shifts, is that they're really having to confront this in a big way. And they're saying, oh, wait, even if we have a childcare center on site, we can't just have it open from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. We need to accommodate families of all types with all of these different needs. And in some cases, that means workers who are working overnight and have to drop their kids off, having beds for them, having toothbrushes for them, whatever the case may be. But I think we are finally starting to think about these things that should have been front and center a long time ago.
Well said. So one thing that I think a lot about as a working mom now of 5 kids is the idea of productivity. And economists, they have a specific idea of productivity. Our culture is obsessed with being, quote, productive. And yet there is so much in motherhood and parenthood in general that isn't so-called productive in this classic sense, in the way that economists measure it, in the way that we mean when we study productivity gurus and methodologies. For example, this morning I made breakfast for my kids. I helped them put their school uniforms on. I breastfed my baby. I cleaned the kitchen. I put my baby down for a nap. All of that happened instead of me being at work starting at 7 a.m. or 8 a.m. And according to our culture, economic measures, what I did wasn't productive. And I do think part of changing ultimately the systems and structures around us is also really questioning how we define these things. Because to be clear, I think this work that I do and that all parents do is incredibly meaningful and productive, but it's not classically defined as such. I'm curious your take on that topic.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And we are at a point where there's a real reckoning over how to measure productivity and whether that really captures what people are feeling. And I think we've seen a lot of that bubble up over the last few years. We had the Great Resignation, where all of these workers were quitting and saying, you know what, I can find something that's better for me. And people are really starting to prioritize what they think is important. But I also think being a parent just makes you so much more efficient. Like as me as a worker, I mean, I don't know how to measure productivity per se, but I will say I have become a much more efficient worker than I was before kids. And so that's not nothing. I feel like that's an important part of the conversation.
I completely agree with you. I had kids fairly young, as you know, because I was pregnant when we were working together at the Post. I was 27 when our son was born. And I remember going back to work at the Post after I had Henry. I could get the whole day worth of work done in 2 or 3 hours. And I just remember thinking, what did I do? What was I doing when I was sitting there? And it's not a judgment on people who don't have kids, or even the person that I was before. But I think, in a way, parenthood can be this transformation into efficiency in a way that I think actually has lessons for the future of work, the future of the economy. And what I mean by that is, I think we're starting to really ask questions around, what does it mean to get your job done? Experiments like remote work, where people aren't really measuring how many hours a day you're sitting your butt in a chair, but they're seeing the outcome of your work. And I wonder your perspective on 40, 50 hour work week versus the gig economy versus impact-based work. Like, where is this all heading? Because it just seems to me like the idea of a 9 to 5 is a relic at this point. And parents may know that better than everyone else.
Absolutely. And I remember going back to the office after I had my first kid and having the same feeling of like, what was I doing? And now it was so important to me to get out of there at 5 o'clock that I was going to work through lunch, really hunker down and get out of there at any cost possible and get my work done. But I think the pandemic has really been transformational in making people realize that you can be productive in many different ways that might look different day to day or week to week. And it's empowered them in a lot of ways. I mean, there's still this push and pull of trying to figure out what this new equilibrium is going to be. What does it mean to set your own hours when your employer expects you in the office for a certain number of hours a day or days per week? But I think people have also realized that, hey, like if I take 2 hours and work at night, like that's so much more productive than 4 hours during the day. And so maybe I'm going to do that. That's what I do a lot of the time. And so I think we're all kind of settling in and trying to figure out where the sweet spot is. But it's really heartening that we're in this place because we weren't a few years ago.
I completely agree with you. And I say that as a family who is directly affected by COVID. We lost a family member. It was hell to live through as a society. And so I want to acknowledge that directly. And when it came to these issues, that I'm happy to hear you say that you are hopeful and that the crisis that we went through has led to some breakthroughs that are definitely encouraging for me. Like when I think about what working motherhood might look like for my daughter, I don't think she's going to know the sense of conflict that was inherent in early narratives that I grew up with around working motherhood. I don't know what work-life harmony is going to look like 25 years from now, but I don't think they need to be at war with one another in the way that I think has been the narrative around this topic for a long time.
That's a really great point. And I really hope that's true.
Let's talk a little bit more about how we value caregiving in our society. I read a post the other day where someone pointed out the fact that so many schools run on the free labor of mothers, right? On volunteer organizations, class moms, the PTA, and there's this workforce that's unpaid around raising kids where they do critical work. They're not compensated for it. And it can be confusing, I think. I certainly was one who 6, 7 years ago was volunteering for organizations like that. And now I'm like, I appreciate that people do it, but it is not labor that I'm any longer able to take on. Let's talk just about that caregiving aspect and that unpaid labor, for example, as it comes out in the PTA or school-related labor. But why is it that the work that we have done historically and classically as women and mothers has not been valued with an economic value associated with it?
I mean, at the most basic level, I think after the Industrial Revolution, we were in this stage where the work that was valued was how many widgets you were making on the assembly line outside of the home. And the people who could work outside of the home at that point were men, because women had to stay home and deal with things at home, deal with the childcare. And that just became the norm that really defined what was a contribution to society and the economy and what wasn't. And a lot of that has persisted in really depressing ways. And I'm glad to hear you say that you've also stepped out of the PTA world, because I'm at this point where I'm like, I just have too many balls in the air. I just can't do this. And I'm glad people can, and more power to them. But I feel like we haven't done a good job of sorting through all of that, especially when it comes to that hidden unpaid work that's behind the scenes of so many entrenched things in society.
I am so glad you brought up the Industrial Revolution, because I spent a lot of time thinking about this, because it is helpful to me as a working mom with all the things I got to juggle and all the expenses of childcare and all the things. It's helpful for me to remember that in the long view of human history, we are not living in normal times. And work and life and the way that we value labor, as we understand it, really shifted after the Industrial Revolution. And I personally am hopeful, because when I take this broader view of the role that women play in the economic life, not just of the world at large, but also within the home, it just seems so obvious that before the Industrial Revolution, men and women and their families and communities together were largely, for all of human history, operating out of the home in flexible and creative ways, all participating and all being valued as part of the home economy. And I think when we came back home for the pandemic, it just almost philosophically opened up new ways of looking at what work could be and mean into the future in a way that makes me hopeful, even if it sounds like I'm suggesting going back to like the olden times, which I'm not, but I'm just reimagining how we value the work that happens at home and with your family, which, as we know, often puts women at the center of the conversation around household labor and the kind of work that we value.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because Claudia Golden, a professor at Harvard University, just won the Nobel Prize in Economics for this very point, that women's role in the workforce has not gone from zero to where we are now, that a lot more women were actually in the workforce before the Industrial Revolution because they could do it from home, because we were an agriculture society where everybody was working and handling family duties at once. And I really like your parallel to how the pandemic forced everyone to hunker back down at home and really sort of return to that sort of society that we were back in the day. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think it has sort of made people reshuffle the way that they balance things within their homes and also externally with their jobs.
Well, that's my weird sort of pet theory about the universe that I spend a lot of time thinking about, and even as I figure out how to apply that to the future of my own career. So your parents were born in Nepal. They moved to Texas, where you were born and raised in Austin. What was their vision for you and your life? Did they see you becoming an economics reporter?
Wow, you'd have to ask them. I don't know what they saw in my future. My dad came here for grad school, and I know education and making your mark in society was a driving force for both him and my mom, who came after they got married. And so in a lot of ways, they grew up in very different societies than I did. And my mom used to say growing up that she felt like she was going to elementary school and middle school and high school for the first time when I did, because those were experiences that she just hadn't seen. And she also didn't have a lot of opportunities. She had an accounting degree in Nepal, but she really wanted to go to medical school. And that was just not something that was available to women at the time. And so my parents, I think, brought that understanding with them. And that's what they were hoping for in the United States, is that my brother and I would have all of these opportunities available to us that they didn't have. But at the same time, I mean, I also saw them really struggle with the flip side of things, it was just our family for a long time. Now I have hundreds of aunts and uncles and cousins in Texas, but for a long time, it was just my family in Austin. And we didn't have the sort of networks that they did back home in terms of childcare and familial help. And my mom was in school when I was growing up. She went back to college. And I just remember her sort of having to piece everything together. And she would stay up all night studying, then be up in the morning to get us ready for school. And she would go to classes until three, then come pick us up from school. And she was really shouldering all of the childcare and everything else in a way that I don't think she would have had to in a different society. And even now, we hopefully as an American society have also evolved to a point where I feel like it's a lot easier for me to manage those things than it was for my parents.
How do you think watching your mom endure through her educational journey, her career, how did that shape you and your motivation or your hopes for yourself and your own family?
It was always amazing to me that my mom was able to go to college, get this high-powered engineering job, and still be there for us. It was really selfless of her in a way that I just can't do and don't want to do because it's a lot. But it was really incredible to me. And it set an example. I still really value dinner time with my kids. Like, no matter how crazy things are at work, I take an hour, we make dinner together usually, we eat together. So those types of little things have really stuck with me. And growing up, I saw my mom studying a lot or working, and like she was always there. She maybe wasn't playing with us all the time because she had other things to do, and we respected that. And so that's really helped me keep things in perspective as well, especially during the pandemic where I was trying to not feel guilty about having to work, but at the same time realizing that it's empowering for my girls to see that I'm working and that I really love my job. And that's something that I try to remember, especially as home and work blend together more and more after the pandemic.
As a busy working mom who covers the economy and all the topics that affect other working parents, I guess I'm wondering, what gives you hope about the future of women and mothers and work?
I think there's been such an amazing transformation in the workforce in the last few years. Women have really felt empowered to take on jobs that work for them. And we've seen working moms in particular return to the workforce at record levels. They've really propelled all of this amazing economic growth that we've had in the past few years. I mean, I hope this childcare cliff doesn't become such a huge burden that it takes a lot of these women back out of the workforce. But we are at a point where I think women feel like their work is valued, I hope, in the labor force. And they are there at record levels, which is a great thing.
So at Motherly, we believe that motherhood brings out our superpowers. I don't think that moms are superhuman, but what I mean by superpowers is skills or strengths, things about us that amaze us, things often that weren't even there before we became moms. So I'm curious, what do you see as your superpower?
Gosh, I've never thought about it that way. But the fact that we're all still standing, I mean, you know, it's like, I can't tell you, especially in the last few years, how many times I've just called my mom and been like, okay, I've reached my breaking point. This is just not going to work. My kids won't go to bed. It's 10 o'clock. I have all this work to catch up on. The house is a mess. It's all a big disaster. And somehow it turns out okay. And I think what I've maybe learned, which I mean, I wouldn't call it a superpower, but something that I've learned along the way is just to prioritize in a really big way and just handle what needs to be handled at that moment. And I think that's really helped put things in perspective and also just kind of helps the important things rise to the top.
Love that. Abba Badarai, thank you so much for joining us on the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you, Liz.
Well, that's it for this episode. Abba, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. We will be back next week with another great guest. You don't want to miss it. The Motherly Podcast is executive produced by Jennifer Bassett. Our associate producer is Carolyn Silvera. Editing is by Joel Edinburg. Our music is from the Blue Dot Sessions. I'm your host, Liz Tennedy. Thank you so much for listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.